Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob Inyart Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church and host of Real Science Radio. And 50 years ago this week was a conference in Philadelphia, the Wistar Conference. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about that. A Nobel laureate, world-renowned mathematicians, professors from MIT and Harvard. And they said that the math was a tremendous challenge to a politically correct theory of their day, neo-Darwinian evolution. So we'll look at that in just a few minutes. But first, there is a film that you'll be able to see in a theater near you Monday night, and it's a Fathom event. Can't wait to see this film. Our crew and I here, we're planning on going to the theater together to talk about Climate Hustle. We have with us, what an honor to have one of the writers and a producer of the film, Craig Rucker. Craig, welcome to Bob Inyart Live.
It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Craig, we have followed the whole global warming hype for many years now, since it began as a phenomenon, and I've been on the air for 25 years now. Our audience knows a lot about the science, so if you could tell us about the film.
Yeah, sure, Bob. Our film deals with the subject of climate change, or what used to be called global warming, and we try to do a kind of a takedown on it, looking at the various aspects of the science. We look at the history of climate scares, address some of the things that formerly were global cooling and an impending ice age, and now have flipped to global warming. We interview tons of scientists.
In fact,
30-plus scientists that are in this program, formerly politically left scientists,
that
have looked at the data and changed their minds.
Hey, Craig, you're having a little bit of a hard time hearing me, so we'll try to solve that. I'm going to step away from the microphone for 5 seconds, go across the studio, and grab a book that I want to read the title to you for. Okay, hold on 1 sec. Okay, the book is by Lowell Ponte, and it's called The Cooling. And on the back, you've got endorsements from the National Center for Atmospheric Research and Senator Claiborne Pell. And so, Craig, you know about this book, right? It was the global cooling scare of the 1970s.
Absolutely. And I remember it vividly, having been raised in Buffalo, New York, during a time in 1977. I remember the Parker Brothers made a game called The Blizzard of 77 because our city was so taken over by snow and ice, and it was frequent on television and radio at that time that this was part of an impending new ice age that we were long past due. And we have in the film audio clips and visual clips of Leonard Nimoy of Star Trek fame talking how scientists had a consensus back then that it would be global cooling, and of course it switched. Folks will have a chance to see this. It's Monday, May 2nd, one night only, as you said, and you can get the details by going to climatehustle.com to find out theaters and locations near you.
Climatehustle.com, sort of like a sister site for climatedepot.com. We have appreciated the team, basically, that's come together to put this film on for years, because when folks in our audience, when they began to hear the truth about how the data was manipulated and is continuing to be manipulated, about all the unethical behavior in the name of science, about the bullying and intimidation, all to promote something that supposedly carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going to destroy our way of life. It's so easy to expose, yet our mainstream media, they accept it as though it were gospel.
Exactly. And you'll see in this movie, we take on a lot of the alarmist claims that the Greens have been saying in recent years, that global warming's increasing the melting of the polar caps, that polar bears are disappearing, that wildfires are increasing, and even some of the crazy stuff that they say about how it impacts prostitution and drug and gambling and things of that sort. They've linked it to almost everything. We take a look at that and see if the data stacks up, and we try to be entertaining in this. This is not just a film that's going to be kind of a dry go-through and you hear a bunch of stats and statistics. We liken it to a hustle, and we use a lot of humor. we, you know, just let the other side kind of hang themselves on their own words. And then, as I said, we have a lot of people from the political left that are in this film, people who are true believers in the climate change narrative, names like Judith Curry from Georgia Institute of Technology, Robert Giganack from the University of Pennsylvania, Richard Toll, a former UN scientist. These are not small names, and they're people with great credentials taking on this data and showing the audience why it's wrong and why we're being misled.
It turns out that the data, historical data, is being systematically changed in the early decades of the 20th century to make it look like it was cooler, and in the later decades to make it look like it was heating to fit in with the narrative. Some of the scientific evidences that have been forged, are some of those part of the film?
Absolutely. We'll take a look and show, for example, one of the big things is how important is CO2? Is it the tail that wags the dog?
Right.
Is it the principal driver of our climate? And Mark Morano looks into this by talking to some good scientists, use a little humor. Al Gore in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth, got up on this escalator and started showing people where trends were and how it's increasing. Well, Mark does the same thing and goes up there and shows how Al Gore was wrong in what he said. We also take on some of the claims about polar bears. Are they actually decreasing in number, or are they becoming so populous that people are having to shoo them away from their kids while they're trick-or-treating in some of these northern communities?
And Mark is Mark Morano, one of our heroes. I don't know if you know the name Calvin Beisner. Calvin wrote the widely read open letter to Pope Francis on global warming that a number of authorities, scientists, co-signed. We had him on the show a few months back. This is going to be fun. If anyone in our audience in the Denver metro area wants to go see the show together, we'll put on our website on kgov.com. We'll put the theater and the time of the showing that we're going to go. But all around the country, it's a Fathom event, so you're going to want to see it. Craig Rucker, thank you so much, Craig.
It's been a pleasure, Bob. You have a great day.
Okay, appreciate you. It's going to be a fun film. Not everything we do in educating ourselves is funny and makes you laugh, but this is going to be good. Sort of like Clinton Cash, this is going to be a great film. Looking forward to it. Okay, now, 50 years ago this week, on a Friday and Saturday in Philadelphia, on the University of Pennsylvania campus, there were dozens of the world's most expert minds in mathematics and engineering, and they met for the Wistar Conference. Now, what's that? These were professors from MIT and from Harvard and from England. They invited their colleagues from other universities, and especially the biology professors. Those who came from Massachusetts were invited to take the half-day drive south to the prestigious Wistar Institute. Others had to fly across the Atlantic. And they were all in Philadelphia on a day that's very similar to today in Denver, Colorado. It was a chilly and damp weekend. And they were there to discuss an amazing topic, especially when you realize how intensely secular and politically correct MIT has always been. They were gathering to question mathematically whether or not Darwinian evolution were even possible. Is Darwinian evolution possible? Now, our Ivy League schools, just like Oxford and Cambridge over in England, they were founded by Christians as places of religious study. Harvard, you'll recall, was named for a Christian minister, right? Yale was started by clergymen. Princeton, to this day, their crest says, "Under God she flourishes." Under God. But MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that school was first proposed in 1859. And I remember that because that was the year that Darwin published Origin of Species. And just a couple years later, it became reality. And the governor signed MIT's charter to establish a school focused not on God, but focused on the study of the physical laws. So it's remarkable that MIT, a century after its own secular founding and after the publication of Origin of Species, would see its own professors take the lead in organizing a challenge to Darwinism. So the WISTAR conference, it was held at a famed biomedical research facility named after a Philadelphia physician, a Dr. WISTAR, Caspar WISTAR. That provided the forum for these men who themselves had a secular worldview. So these were not young earth creationists. They were secular professors from the world's leading institutions. Yet a number of them presented a logical argument, a virtual mathematical proof, if you will, that Darwin's theory of evolution must be false. And since then, in the half century since WISTAR, their argument has multiplied in strength with all the growth and knowledge in the intervening decades. I'll give you a couple examples, right? Thanks to the National Institutes of Health, their website promoting a paper published in a peer-reviewed journal, Genetics, we here at Bob and Yurt Live and Real Science Radio, we were able to share with our audience that there is now an estimate, a very sophisticated estimate, on how difficult and how wildly time-consuming it would be through mutations, right? A mutation is a random change in a DNA molecule of an organism. How wildly time-consuming it would be through mutations, random changes, to come up with one little part of cellular life, something called a binding site. Maybe later in the program, we could talk about what a binding site is. But if the WISTAR mathematicians had this information that it would take millions of years by random chance to come up with the sequence needed for a binding site, they would have, I mean, this information, right, that has been learned, this is published in the last decade, and if they had this information back then, 50 years ago, they would have laughed and said that that proved their argument 1,000 times over. If it's going to take millions of years just to come up with a binding site, it's almost like a loading dock at a trucking depot. Millions of years just for that? And Darwinism claims that random mutation is the engine that created the diversity for natural selection in all of the kingdoms of life. And then here's another example. We could give so many. How about orphan genes? Have you heard of orphan genes? You know what orphan genes are? Right? Genes are the instructions for building proteins. Proteins are little machines in our cells, little molecular machines that do things for us. And genes that are not related to any other known genes, they're called orphan genes by geneticists. The modern theory of Darwinian evolution would predict that there should be no or virtually no orphan genes, that genes should all be related to other genes and pre-existing genes. Why is that? Well, just like they claim all organisms have evolved from small changes to pre-existing organisms. And so if you map out their history, you would draw a tree of life. And so too, if you look at the genes that help to build organisms, that they too would all have evolved from small changes to pre-existing genes. And so if you map out all the genes of the world's organisms, you'll find them all related to their ancestors and all related to one another, with small changes separating and differentiating them. Except that's not true. Back in the 1960s, mainstream biologists believed, like they do today, that our DNA and the genomes of all species evolved by genes gradually changing through random and small incremental changes into other genes, and so on through millions of species. And so if you had the data, then the genetic sequencing of those species, right, if you had that, you would find generally that all those genes would be related to one another, just like on a tree of life, a molecular tree of life, with small changes in the genetic instructions for one protein leading to a variation, and so to yet another gene that builds yet another protein, and then another and another, each just slightly different from its predecessor. But fast forward to the year 2016. Molecular biologists have so far published the genomes of about 20,000 different species. 20,000. The human genome has 3 billion letters in it, 3 billion base pairs of amino acids, like on a spiral staircase. Each rung is a different letter. 3 billion. Most organisms have fewer. Well, that's really awesome that they've done this. Published the genomes of 20,000 different species. They have sequenced the letters of the DNA of all these different kinds of organisms, mostly of bacteria. About 18,000 of the 20,000 genomes sequenced so far have been of bacteria, but also they've sequenced hundreds of fungus species. That doesn't sound too interesting yet, right? We like the bigger creatures. Well, they've sequenced about 100 insects, 100 plants, about 100 mammals, and 100 or so fish, and so on. And there is a public domain worldwide database of these genomes. And the genes that have been identified so far are listed publicly. Amazingly and wonderfully, something we creationists celebrate, countless species have what scientists are calling orphan genes. Orphans. They're genes that are not related to any known gene. And you can learn more about that topic, at rsr.org/genes. Real Science Radio, rsr.org/genes. Learn about orphan genes. Now, here's a prediction from a young Earth creationist. The more genomes we sequence, if we get to 100,000 genomes, if the Lord tarries and we get to 1 million genomes, the gaps that separate orphan genes from other genes will not be filled in. There will continue to be not fewer and fewer orphan genes because we're finding their related genes, that their sister genes and their cousin genes and their grandpa genes and all. But the gaps will increase. There will be a steadily increasing number of orphan genes. Okay, that's a prediction from a young Earth creationist. Bill Nye, the science guy, and Neil deGrasse Tyson, they both recently said creationists cannot make predictions. Science predictions based on the Bible. And so we responded to that, rsr.org/predictions, and you'll see all of our science predictions that have come stunningly confirmed, stunningly. And so there's yet another one. We'll have to add that to our page, rsr.org/predictions. Okay, so I'll give you an example of these orphan genes. Think of a little ant, right? You got an insect, an ant. And so you take one of its cells, or the way they do it with DNA sequencing, they might take a bunch of cells. Our DNA is about the same in all our cells, except for mutations. And they begin to sequence it. In other words, the letters of our DNA, the amino acids in the nucleotides, what is the order of the letters for a species' DNA, its genome? And they find it. And they say, well, look at this. You know, human beings, we have about 20,000 genes, about the same number as a kangaroo. Not all that different from the number of genes, not all that different from bananas and sponges and whatever. But we have about 20,000. Ants have some thousands of genes. And it turns out many hundreds of them, even about 1,000, are orphan genes in just a little ant species. They can't find those genes in any other species that they have sequenced. So then they say, oh, okay, well, we'll sequence another ant species. And then we'll find all those because the ants are all related. So they sequence the next ant species, and they find out that that one has hundreds or 1,000 orphan genes, totally unrelated to any other organism and unrelated to the other ant species. So they're totally different. And so evolution, Darwinism, would claim that these ants are so similar that their genes would be extremely similar just with the slightest modifications. Just a little tweak to make one ant species different from another. But that's not the way God wanted to do it, because God likes to be creative. And so in something like a little insect, he could put 1,000 different, amazingly complex genes because he likes to do it. And how many ant species are there? Are there thousands of ant species? 1,000? Hundreds? And so far, as best we know, the more ant genomes we sequence, the greater the number of orphan genes, not the lesser the number. And so at the Wistar Conference, the MIT professors of mathematics and engineering, they had their, about 12,000 ant species, according to my producer. Thank you. So 12,000. So if the evolutionists were right in their theory, then the more ant species we sequence, the fewer orphan genes we should find, because they're all going to be connected in relationship. And creationism suggests that that doesn't need to be the case, because God is free and he's creative and he could do whatever he wants in the design of proteins and genes for different species. So these MIT professors of math and engineering, they had doctorates in their disciplines. And as best we can tell, to a man, they did not believe, they didn't argue that God created us, but rather they believed that we came about through some kind of natural mechanism. They had no idea what that mechanism might be, the ones who were making this argument, even though they were evolutionists. So they were evolutionists by faith, but some of them made the strong argument, still not refuted a half century later, that simple mathematics falsifies, that it could disprove neo-Darwinian evolution, which that form of the theory is the theory to this very day. It's fed to millions of students on college campuses and to TV audiences by the BBC and Nova and the Discovery Channel. And if they would have known back then about protein binding sites, which we are told in the journal Genetics that it could take 100 million years, 100 million years for random mutations to bring about a binding site. What is a binding site? Well, on a protein molecule, it's a place sort of like a docking, like a dock at a warehouse where a truck backs up to, but not more than that, sort of like a space shuttle docking on the space station where they dock and they connect perfectly. It's like that. A binding site on a protein molecule, it's where transcription factors, other molecules, can fit and attach perfectly to do their job. They also have binding sites on our DNA molecules. So a DNA strand, an RNA strand, they have binding sites. So this journal, and as you can read on the government's own website, NIH.gov, National Institutes of Health, it takes 100 million years for random mutation to come up with a configuration for a single binding site that then natural selection could say, hey, that helps this organism survive, so let's reproduce more. That would have multiplied the force of the Wistar argument 1,000 times over. And then, if they had known about orphan genes, they would have told their biology colleagues to just pack it up, go back to the drawing board, because this Darwinism is falsified by the most basic mathematical observations. But how could mathematics disprove a theory of evolution? Good question. Glad I thought of it. How could mathematics disprove a theory of evolution? Well, if there were no God, and therefore the origin of the world and the origin of life had no creator, if life is not the result of intent, that God intended to make biological organisms, African violets, seahorses, falcons, then that means that life would be the result of physical processes. And mathematics is the language of physics. Math is not the language of love. It's not the language of the rules of etiquette, nor of the rules of grammar. It's not the language of the laws of logic, but it is the language of physics. And so whether it is a gravitational field or electromagnetism, nuclear forces, or chemistry, physics, if something happens in that realm, math has been the greatest tool in the scientist's toolbox for understanding the world. And like all fundamental laws, the laws of mathematics are discovered. They're not invented. Politicians can't pass a law that might actually change addition or fractions or squares, any more than they could pass a law to change inertia. And notice that math is not an observational science. For our mathematical comprehension is not based on how good your five senses are. A Stanford or Princeton mathematician, they might have lousy taste, right? Might even be blind or deaf. But still, he could make discoveries using his mind, including mathematical discoveries. So math, logic, and reason, they describe a reality beyond the physical senses. A reality that is, you know, it's ironic, and to use a pun, a reality that is far more substantive than the physical world. And information belongs to that list of non-physical entities. Love, math, the laws of logic, reason, and information, these are all non-physical. Information, you know, none of these, they have no mass, no physical dimension, no motion, no inertia, fields or forces, no temperature or pressure, right? They have no energy and perform no work. And while it drives atheists crazy to think about it, they are non-physical, the laws of logic and of math and information and so on. It's all non-physical. So you might ask, well, why is it that mathematics, which seems to some wrongly, but it seems to them to be a product of the human intellect, why is it that math wonderfully describes the cosmos, the universe, which seems to obey the laws of physics that are mathematically elegant? Why is that? Atheists have been unable to offer an answer to this nagging question. We're producing a new science video, Real Science Radio's list of evidence against the Big Bang. And in that video, we will look at the fine-tuning of the universe and the evidence, the positive evidence for our Creator God. Well, when you look at the universe and how it could be described in such a beautiful way mathematically, you see the dilemma that the atheists have. Einstein wrestled with it for decades, and he admitted the problem to be unfathomable. We did a program on this, RSR Goes to Math Class, just to investigate that question. If you're interested in that, you could go online to rsr.org/math. But here's what Einstein said back in 1921, and he continued this right through the 1940s, repeating the same theme, this dilemma. He wrote, "How can it be that mathematics, being after all a product of human thought, which is independent of experience, is so admirably appropriate to the objects of reality?" So these atheists, they want to know, how could it possibly be? Like E equals MC squared. How could that perfect equation describe the functioning of the universe? How could it be? It's too perfect. It doesn't make any sense. And that's because they reject the answer. The answer is God. The answer is God. So God is a person with a mind. And so God conceived of the design of the universe. And he's the ultimate mathematician. And as he did, he conceived of these elegant equations and he implemented them in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth. He implemented those equations. And that's why what they're looking at, they're seeing the thoughts of God. They're looking into the mind of God, but they don't realize it. And because they don't realize that, they think, as Einstein said, it's an unsolvable problem. It simply cannot be solved. Well, that's math, and math doing such a great job of describing the physical universe. Well, how about the subject of evolution? At the Wistar Conference, the event's chairman, he's one of the amazing, there were over 50 scientists at this event, and this was Sir Peter Medawar. He's a British Nobel Prize-winning biologist. And here's how he opened the conference. Here's his opening remark. "The immediate cause of this conference is a pretty widespread sense of dissatisfaction about what has come to be thought of as the accepted evolutionary theory, the so-called neo-Darwinian theory. These objections to current neo-Darwinian theory are very widely held among biologists generally, and we must on no account, I think, make light of them. And so the theory, the proceedings of the theory were published in a book, and that book, it was the following year, 1967, and it was titled Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution. And so the scientist, it was not only that one Nobel Prize-winning scientist, it was names, and if you enjoy science, you might recognize names like Murray Eden, Ernst Mayr, Richard Lewontin. We're talking about some of the world's leading evolutionists, leading mathematicians. I mean, the University of Paris mathematician Marcel Paul Schützenberger. And they came together, and the mathematicians presented this argument that some of the biologists said, you know, we got to deal with this. And it was, there simply is not enough time. Forget about a billion years of life on Earth. Forget about 3 billion years of life on Earth. If you have the whole 15 billion years of the alleged age of the universe, there's not enough time. There simply is not enough time. You could take a sentence out of Shakespeare and try to arrive at that sentence by random permutations. And you could take every atom in the universe being a little laboratory, doing a million tries per second, in the whole universe, all the matter of the universe, for 15 billion years, you can't get at the sentence. And so, yeah, they say natural selection, but the point of the mathematicians at Wistar was natural selection is a conservative process. It selects those organisms that are most fit for survival. Now, scientists have shown even recently that they'll do an experiment with 50 different species of yeast. They have the hardest time in the world even getting that to work. The fit species to survive better. It's the way God designed ecosystems with redundant functionality. It's like the whole global warming scare. If the temperature goes up a half a degree, we get more evaporation from the oceans, more clouds. That increases the Earth's albedo. More of the sun's radiation reflects back into outer space, and it rains. And so the Earth heats up a little, and so it cools itself back down. That and so many other mechanisms to provide for a safe place for life on Earth. As God said in Genesis, you'll always have summer and winter, spring and fall, until the Lord returns. And so even at that level, with Darwin's theory, the survival of the fittest part, God designed ecosystems, many with 1,000 interacting species that provide biological services for one another, that they would be robust. So even if there's a species that human beings look at it and they say, well, that's not very fit for survival, but it's still here. And so even at that level, Darwin's theory, it has shocked evolutionists that they have tried to show that that aspect of Darwin's theory is right, and they failed to do even that. But these guys at the conference are getting to something prior to that. Prior to the survival of the fittest, you need the arrival of the fittest. And so for the arrival of some novel function that's encoded in our DNA, for that to arrive, it first has to arrive via random mutations. At least some part of it that is then functional enough that natural selection can grab a hold of it and reproduce it. The survival of the fittest. So Darwin, at some level, explains survival of the fittest, but not the arrival of the fittest. So this Nobel laureate, who was the conference chairman, Sir Medawar, I think he won his Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine, he was saying that there's a strong argument against neo-Darwinian theory, and that neo-Darwinism, all it is Darwin's Origin of Species updated for the discovery of DNA. So once they discovered DNA, the information written on our genome for building proteins and regulating development and functionality of cells and organisms, when they discovered that, they wanted to incorporate genes into Darwin's theory. And so they said, okay, genes mutate, random mistakes when cells copy and when there is the conception, a fertilization of an egg. And so those mistakes are the raw material for evolution to work on. So that's called neo-Darwinism. So that's what this chairman of the Wistar Conference was talking about. And that's the theory we have today, this very day, the theory of evolution. Well, who's the father of neo-Darwinism? Who did that synthesis? Well, I see that my producer knows. He's mouthing it. Theodosius Dobzhansky. Very good. Very smart. And I wrote a paper published in a peer-reviewed creation journal titled Dobzhansky 40 Years Later. It turns out the predictions he made in the most famous evolution article ever written, ever, all his predictions have failed. They've all been disproven. His paper was titled, Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution. Today, his arguments have fallen by the wayside. And it was his neo-Darwinian theory that this conference was looking at. They had it square in their sights of their guns. Now, in the last 50 years, who has been taking this problem to the world? Has it been the famous evolutionist like Richard Dawkins or Jerry Coyne or P.Z. Myers? You know, folks we've interviewed or sparred with here on Bob and Yurt Live. No, it's not. It's been mostly the creationist and the ID proponents, those who support the theory of intelligent design. We are the ones who have taken these problems seriously, and we are the ones who have noticed, along with a handful of other scientists who are, let's say, more secular than even the ID camp, we're noticing that these arguments are far stronger today than they were back then. Paul Nelson, a friend of Real Science Radio, he's been on the show. In fact, the Discovery Institute in Seattle, I think we've had about a half a dozen of their guys, their fellows, their authors on this program, their video producers. And Paul Nelson's been on the show, and he summed up this whole Wistar conference by saying, it looks like the math is not going to cooperate. But he's pointed out that there is a Royal Society meeting coming up later this year, this over in England, and it's called New Trends in Evolutionary Biology. He is predicting that it's going to be a replay of the Wistar Conference, where you have world-renowned scientists saying Darwinism doesn't work, Darwinism has failed. So we'll find out if Paul Nelson is right. I made a prediction earlier in the show about science. This prediction is a psychological prediction, what these people are going to say. But chances are he's right. Well, as we creationists point out the results of the Wistar Conference and the argument, you have evolutionists like P.Z. Myers, right? He's a squid expert. Jerry Coyne, he's a fruit fly expert. I mean, you got to be expert in something, right? So you get a fruit fly expert, and they'll get upset. And how dare mathematicians weigh in on biology? What do they know? Well, what a great question. You see, if the reductionists are correct, if biology is all about parts, right? If biology is all about physics and chemistry, then it is the domain of the mathematician. The textbooks that are filled with mathematical formulas are astronomy textbooks and chemistry and physics, because math is the language of science. But biology textbooks, they should also be characterized by these complex mathematical formulae if, in fact, biological life is just a matter of physics. But biology textbooks are not filled with formula after formula 1,000 times over. They're not. Life is not physics-based. Life is not carbon-based. It is information-based. And information is not physical. However, as one of the many ways of falsifying Darwinism, if biological life was primarily a matter of physics, then the mathematicians should be among the most qualified to understand the subject. So PZ, Jerry Coyne, Richard Dawkins, stop complaining, because if biology was all about physics, then you should welcome the mathematicians. However, molecular biology is an utter mystery to the typical mathematician. It's a world unlike anything he has prepared himself for, and anything that his expertise has enabled him to understand. One of the reasons that biology textbooks admit that life is so very hard to define, and why world-class scientists acknowledge the difficulty of producing a robust definition for life, is that living things exist within the physical world, but life itself is not based on anything physical, but on information and intent. It is the intention of the creator that the mountain lion can jump from ledge to ledge. That it could what? Jump up in a tree, like 15 feet up in the tree. It could sprint at 50 miles per hour. It's the intention of the creator that that creature could do those things. Isaac Newton said, when he was rejecting the claim that gravity could form the solar system from a gas cloud, he said, there is no other reason why these things are so other than that the creator of the system desired them to be that way. God said, let there be light, and there was light. And he brought forth fish and birds on day five, and then land animals, and finally mankind, Adam and Eve, male and female, on the sixth day of creation, when he instituted marriage. And so we've had marriage from then until now, and now it's under assault. Even the bathrooms are under assault. But anyway, that's off topic. So, like love and envy, logic and reason, math and grammar, information itself is not physical. And because life is information-based and has to do with the intent of the creator, therefore, scientists have a hard time defining life apart from the recognition of the living God. Just as no one could properly define human being without reference to a person being made in God's image and likeness. You cannot accurately define a human being without reference to our Creator. If the whole history of the universe, even if it were as old as atheists claim, 14.8 billion years, and if every atom in the universe were an experiment capable of trying a million permutations per second, you still wouldn't have enough time to generate the order of the genetic letters, the instructions, to build the proteins we found in living creatures, if the whole universe was working on it for 15 billion years. Some of those proteins are very long. A typical protein is, what, a couple hundred amino acids, a chain in a certain order, and then it folds just right to perform an amazing function, right? And some proteins are so long, in 15 billion years, and exhausting all the physical interactions within the entire universe, you couldn't come up with the order of those proteins and that lengthy string, not even one of them. And you need the thousands of other proteins, millions, of hundreds of letters. And there isn't enough time to generate them. That's the argument of the WISTAR conference with all these professors from MIT and Harvard and everywhere else, University of Paris. And not all the professors were in agreement. There were those who were defending Darwinian theory. But there are others who were saying, look, the math proves you wrong. And it was a very lively conference, as you could imagine. So basically, the mathematicians told the biologist, although that one Nobel Prize winning biologist was receptive to the argument, that they had blind faith in this magical ability of randomness to come up with the variability needed as the inputs to natural selection, for selection to work on. But natural selection is a conservative tool. It's not a creative tool. The creation of a new function, Darwinism claims that this part is based on a random process. the origin of something new, and then there is no direction, no goal-oriented process allowed. And if that's true, then Darwinism cannot succeed. To summarize the Wistar Conference 50 years ago this week, that's the argument. In our Real Science Radio layman's way of explaining it, certainly you could read the conference proceedings. They were published in Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution back in 1967. The arguments are just as good today, although they are far stronger. And on our show summary for today's program, we're going to link to three of our challenges. And these are so fun. The Richard Dawkins 3-to-1 Evolution Challenge. How could a non-directed material process generate a genetic system whereby three genetic letters code for one amino acid? That's it. Just the 3-to-1 Evolution Challenge. Just the simplest part of evolution. And we predict that no evolutionist or atheist will ever be able to give even a rudimentary possible answer to that question. And that's about the simplest question an evolutionist could be asked about genetics. And then there's our P.Z. Myers-Trochlea challenge. How could the sling in our eye, the human eye, we have a sling that our muscle goes through to turn our eye, our eyeball, how could that sling develop by any Darwinian mechanism? That's a fun one. These are graphical challenges. You look at, you know, the beautiful drawings, and then the presentation is right there on the drawing. And finally, rsr.org/vision challenge, the Evolution Vision Challenge. We have a picture of what a brain sees and what a brain does not see. And think of an insect that's supposed to evolve a vision system, and the visual data passing through his optic nerve to his brain, to his visual cortex, and it has to be interpreted as what he is seeing. And all that's getting through to his brain is static. That's it. It's all static. It's been encoded symbolically, and it needs to be decoded so that the insect could comprehend at some level what it is that he is seeing. And so too for all animals and fish and human beings that have vision systems. And so those three challenges add to the foundational Wistar Conference challenge and make the entire argument of Darwinian evolution passé. It has been falsified. Scientists around the world know it. Just as there are thousands of scientists who reject the Big Bang, there are tens of thousands who reject Darwinian evolution, and the evidence is everywhere around us. On our program, Scholars Doubting Darwin, at rsr.org/doubt, you'll see a list of so many thousands of scholars and scientists who reject Darwinism, and the same is true with the Big Bang. And why is it? It's not because of political correctness, because that would have scientists at these institutions only affirming the Big Bang and affirming Darwinism, but there's a crack in the dike, and it's falling in on them. And they're going to behave more badly than they have even in the past years. And when you think about P.Z. Myers, that's a scary thought, but it's happening. And before we end, I want to tell you about Friday night, June 3rd. It's our Founders Club dinner here in Denver, Colorado, marking the 25th anniversary of the broadcast of Bob Inyart Live and our frequent science shows. Now we do them every Friday on Real Science Radio. Well, this June 3rd will be at Shanahan Steakhouse, our 25th anniversary. It's a fundraiser to help us stay on. Who knows, until the Lord returns, perhaps. But then also, I'd like to tell you about our store, rsr.org. You click on the store, and we've added a new feature. Our most popular science video is the global flood in the hydroplate theory, and now you can watch it streaming. Okay, we have it available on DVD, Blu-ray, Blu-ray and as a download. But for those who'd like to save money but they do want to watch the whole thing, you could, for $4.99, you could stream part one. If you love it, for $4.99, you could stream part two. We think you will love it. And for Fred Williams and myself, Bob Enyart, I want to thank you so very much for tuning into Real Science Radio, our website, rsr.org, and may God bless you.
Talking about